set yourself a goal of doing something other than sitting on the couch and watching football or going out and playing golf. You know, people ask, well, what's your secret? And the only answer that I have is stay active and stay involved.
It's easy to talk about the successes, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I've gotten the chance to ascend Mount Everest, to climb the tallest mountain in every continent, to kayak the Grand Canyon, and I happen to be blind. It's been a struggle to live what I call a no barriers life, to define it, to push the parameters of what it means. And part of the equation is diving into the learning process and trying to illuminate the universal elements that exist along the way. In that unexplored terrain, between those dark places we find ourselves in the summit, exists a map. That map, that way forward, is what we call no barriers.
Today we'll meet George Bosch, who is the chief cook and founder of the Himalayan Stove Project, a humanitarian and philanthropic program dedicated to preserving the Himalayan environment and improving the health of the people by donating and distributing free, clean-burning, fuel-efficient EnviroFit cook stoves for families and transforming the indoor air quality. George is also an adventurer, explorer, photographer, and a creative entrepreneurial businessman. Born in Vienna, George immigrated to the United States as a small child ahead of Hitler's hordes and holds dual U.S. and EU citizenship. He grew up in Chicago and graduated from MIT in 1959 with a Bachelor's of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering and earned an MBA in 1961. He discovered that large corporate life did not suit him, and seeking something more stimulating and rewarding, he moved to Denver in 1968, where he embarked on his adventures as a serial entrepreneur. These endeavors took him from Denver to Anchorage, Tucson, and Phoenix, and eventually to Nepal and around the world.
Welcome to our No Barriers podcast. We're really excited to have George Bosch on with us. Can't wait to have a conversation with him about his life and his work. I know we're all going to be very inspired by his purpose-driven leadership that we're going to hear about. But before we get started, our event, our annual event, No Barriers Summit, is coming up in Lake Tahoe, June 13th to the 15th. We've got a pretty amazing lineup that's going to be joining us. If you've never been to the No Barriers Summit, we encourage you to join. But perhaps you've all heard of My Big Fat Fabulous Life and Whitney Way Thor. She's going to be giving a talk at our event and leading a dance workshop. She started a nonprofit called No Body Shame, really incredible nonprofit that's doing great work. We're going to be featuring Eric, your film.
Yeah. Way to Water is going to be screening at the summit, and old friends like Mandy Harvey coming back to perform, and some new entertainment like, is it Magic Giant?
Yeah, Magic Giant.
Can't wait to listen to them.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
And Whitney, for instance, is such a great no barrier story because, you know, she, because of a medical condition, gained a lot of weight and just said, like, look, I'm not going to sit on the sidelines in this dark place and mourn, you know, all the challenges that have happened in my life. I'm going to get out there and I'm going to be proud. And as I strive for the summit, I'm going to live. And so she, at our last summit, taught dance classes, and it was one of the most inspiring things I've ever listened to. You know, all kinds of people with physical challenges and emotional challenges out there just feeling free to move and dance. And I even got out there and twerked a little bit.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That video was one of the most funny videos we produced, was you twerking.
Yeah. So we asked Whitney back, and she's just so full on no barriers. I go to a lot of events a year, and this one just fills my cup. This is so fulfilling to me to go to these annual summits. So, yeah, I go there with my family every year, and I hope everybody will come and attend.
Yeah, my daughter, who's 11, was asked by my mom a couple weekends back, what's the one thing, if you could do anything in the world, where would you go right now? And she said, I'd go to the No Barriers Summit. And then she thought about a little, or Disney World. So I thought that's pretty good company, you know, if we're up there with Disney World.
Yeah.
So. June 13th to the 15th, nobarrierssummit.org. Check it out if you want to join us.
Well, we've got a true adventurer on with us today.
George Bosch has joined us and want to get started with our conversation. Jeff, you want to kick us off? You guys have known each other for a long time. Give some perspective on our guest.
Well, yeah, and I think the Eric-George relationship started before I met George. So, you know, if I kind of come in to the point where our paths intersected, George, it was, I think it was the winter of 97, 98.
That's correct.
Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm.
So Eric and I were queuing up to go climb Aconcagua, which is the highest point in South America. It's a 22,000 foot mountain down there. And Eric says, you know, he's got this colleague from Phoenix. And I'm not sure the connection. Y'all have to fill in the color there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, George showed up to climb Aconcagua with us. And I remember meeting you in Mendoza or somewhere. And I was like, okay, George has got a decade on us. Was that generous?
A couple.
Maybe let's go with a couple.
I was 60 when you guys were 30.
Yeah.
I think you've got 3 decades.
So let's go with 3. I was trying to be kind and
well, thank
soft
you very
on
much.
That.
No, I mean, you guys are just turning 50 and I'm 82 this year.
82.
Wow.
Yes. So, a few decades.
A few decades.
But I tell you, it very clearly you fell in with the crew and your dynamic and your energy was infectious. And so Eric, maybe back up just a touch.
Well, so first of all, I just want to start out by saying that when I was a young teacher and I was trying to think about this idea of becoming making a life as a climber and an adventurer. And like, this was not an idea of this blind teacher, you know, making this leap and becoming, you know, a full-time adventurer. And I mean, this is not an idea many venture capitalists would have banked on. And George took me under his wing. I taught his son in fifth grade, Chris, and he brought me to his office one day and he started mentoring me. And I told him this wild hair of an idea. And immediately he's bought into it. He's like, look, you know, how are you going to make an income and what's the business plan? And I had no idea. I'm like, I'm an English teacher, dude. Anyway, George helped me think so many of those things through and became such a great role model that I really, I never forgot that. And when I said, we're going to go do Aconcagua, the tallest peak in South America, as part of my Seven Summits quest, George said, I'd like to be a part of that. So he came along with us to South America, excuse me.
Yeah, it wasn't an easy trip.
No.
It wasn't an easy trip for any of us. And
we actually all failed on that first trip to Aconcagua.
I mean, we came back alive, so I'm not sure I would document that as a failure.
Yeah.
So we didn't summit. Let's clarify.
There we go.
We didn't summit. But yeah, it was a tough trip.
So George, have you been an adventurer your entire life?
Yeah, when I was 6 years old, I came to Colorado for the first time and learned to ride and hike. I was born in Austria, and we came over here when Hitler invaded in 1938 and came to Colorado. The first serious vacation that we took was just a few years after we came. So being out in the mountains and doing things is just part of the family DNA and part of my experience from the very earliest years of my life.
What has been the most epic adventure you've gone on in your lifetime?
Well,
that's a setup question,
that's
George.
That's a setup question. I could say Aconcagua. I could say Everest with these guys in 2001. But I just got back from a slightly more than 4-month trip through all of Southern Africa, in Patagonia, Torres del Paine, 16 days down in Antarctica. So that was pretty epic. I just got back from that 3 weeks ago.
You still got your goggle tan. So when you did this, I just find these sorts of journeys really interesting. When you did it, I talked to you before you were leaving, and you had sort of mapped it all out, and you were just taking people as they could join you intermittently. Is that right?
That was the plan, that mm-hmm. some of my colleagues from the Explorers Club would jump in and out, and then everybody bailed. So I was there. The trip was all mapped out. All the reservations were made. And so I talked to my son, Chris, who Eric taught in fifth grade. And he said, well, I'll go along. And so we spent 5 weeks together the first 5 weeks. And then after that, I just did it all alone. We had a rental pickup truck. We drove 11,000 kilometers through Southern Africa, which is 6,600 miles, back and forth across the United States.
And just so everybody's aware, how old are you?
82. 82. I will be next month.
Yeah. So let's call this whole epic journey like in your 81st year.
81st year.
Yeah. Was this Southern Africa or South America?
Well, Southern Africa.
Yes.
Then over to South America.
Wow, both.
For a month. That was 2.5 months in Southern Africa.
Got it.
Then went across, flew from Johannesburg to Santiago, picked up another car down in Punta Arenas, and went to Torres del Paine and to the Argentinian Patagonia. And then I stopped driving and got on this ship through Antarctica for almost 2 weeks.
So what was, I mean, I'm sure you get asked this now a lot. Everybody who goes on these big trips gets asked, but give us the highlight of that trip.
There are two highlights. The first one was spending 5 weeks together with my son. Mm-hmm. That, you know, trumps everything. The second highlight was being on South Georgia Island, which was where Shackleton's mm-hmm. adventure started in 1914 and ended in 1916 when they got back. And we were able to, we had reasonable weather, we were able to climb up to the spine of South Georgia and walk in Shackleton's footsteps for about six miles down to the whaling station. That was really super.
And this was the island that he had this epic journey to, mm-hmm. trying to save his crew. Got to the island, had to trek over almost the whole island, over glaciers and just unbelievable, you know, terrain to get down to a whaling outfit and save his whole crew, right? Everybody lived.
That's correct. Everybody on the whole thing lived. He came across up to 3,000 feet of elevation across glaciers that there was no map. Nobody had ever done it before. And we caught up. It was a 36-mile trek that they did in 39 hours that has not been duplicated in the 100-plus years since then. And Conrad Anker and Reinhold Messner and Stephen Venables tried to duplicate it a few years ago with modern equipment and with ice axes and crampons, which they didn't have back in 1916. And they weren't able to match his time. And we caught up with that path, not on the high point, but at about 1,000 feet above the ocean, and followed it down to the whaling station, which was their salvation at the end of this epic journey.
The endurance.
Yeah.
So that book is, you know, there's a bunch of books about that.
But yeah.
For folks who have not read that, it's probably the most legendary, you know, epic survival story of all time. And I think one of them is this shipwreck at the bottom of the world, the extraordinary true story of Shackleton and the endurance. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing stuff. How cool, man. That's so great that
you're an explorer. I mean, you're part of the Explorers Club, and you're also part of the American Alpine Club, and you're very, very active in all those communities. And you also, George, I know, had a very successful, or you do still have a very successful business. So you're a successful business person.
That's how I can afford to do all this stuff.
Yeah. And you taught, you showed companies how to save money on property taxes, right? And so tell us how this successful business person moves through his life and transitions into some pretty crazy stuff that you know, honestly, you just don't expect somebody to transition into.
Well, I don't know if I've ever shared this with you, but 30-some years ago when I was 50, I was not such a successful businessman, and I had to declare total bankruptcy because I lost my butt in a number of bad investments. And so at 50, I lost everything and started life over again, my financial life over again. And that's when I founded the property tax company in Phoenix, which has now been going for 33 years. I've got a wonderful partner who's doing a lot of the work now, but for many years it was him and me just 24 hours a day, getting back on our feet.
And you've moved into some other stuff, your Himalayan Stove Project, which we're going to talk a lot about. So how did you transition? Because that's like, doesn't seem like the typical path that a person takes, right? Most people kind of transition out of their working, you know, money-making life, and they just kind of sit on the couch and watch football. I don't think you've done a lot of that.
I certainly don't watch football. I was inspired by my father, and he was always active. He was a physician, and he was always active in helping beyond the normal aspects of his practice, and he was always engaged. And so that was part of the family DNA. And when I got out of college, I started doing little bits and pieces of charitable work. The most notable one and for me was when I moved to Colorado in the 70s, and I was on the board of trustees of Colorado Academy for 7 years, and and helped revitalize that organization, along with a lot of other people, and it was not a solo effort. But there was always an aspect of my life in giving back. And unfortunately, in 1998, just after we were together on Aconcagua, my other son, Paul, whom I don't think you ever met, Eric, committed suicide. And I set up a memorial foundation in his memory, and then started looking around for a project. That became a quest, and that was in 98. And after we were at Everest together in 2001.
And just for everyone, you came and trekked to base camp with us when we climbed Everest as part of a awesome team that sent us off.
And greeted us at the bottom when we came down.
That's right.
I spent a month while you guys were climbing.
Yep.
I kept the liaison officer out of your hair.
So one of my favorite pictures is a photo of all of us rolling back down to base camp, like the day we all came back down from standing on top. And you're there. You met us right at like Crampon Point.
Right at the bottom of the ladder.
Yeah, you did. And you're in that image of all of us just raising our hands in joy. So, I mean, that meant a lot to us.
That was an incredible experience. I mean, a month with you guys and a month in that incredible environment.
So how was that one of the catalysts for recognizing and honoring Paul?
It was the beginning of a catalyst, because everybody that treks in Nepal, they go and get invited into the home of a Sherpa family. And if they're burning yak dung, is that okay to say dung?
You can say shit.
Oh, it was yak shit.
Yeah.
And it's the most acrid, horrible stuff. You walk into their homes and they're welcoming you in, and your eyes start watering and you can't breathe.
It's like poison.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And, so everybody's exposed to it. And that didn't really click, other than as being tremendously unpleasant. Then I went back to Nepal in 2009, so what's that, 20 years ago, and went to Upper Mustang.
10 years ago. 2009?
Yeah. Whatever.
Things start to move really quickly. It's okay.
I'm bad at math.
We're accelerating.
MIT didn't teach me how to do math. It's just how to think conceptually. Anyhow, went back to...
I didn't want to jip you of a whole decade there, bro.
Went back to Upper Mustang and got exposed to the same yak shit stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just reinforced what we had seen in 2001. And a few months later, I was trekking in Bhutan, and some guy over dinner who we just met from another trekking team mentioned this very fuel-efficient stove. And it was like a light bulb went on. And I tracked the stove down, and it turns out that the company that designed it and manufactured it is right here in Fort Collins, Colorado, just up the road. And we established a relationship. We sent over 24 test stoves, or 48 test stoves, at the end of 2010. I went back in 11. People loved it. It was solving this problem. It cuts the indoor air pollution by 90%. It reduces fuel consumption by 75%. It cooks twice as fast. It transforms the life of a family.
So people were just cooking stuff over these acrid smoke fires. And why is that a problem, other than just like, the bad smell?
They die.
From what?
Yeah.
Upper respiratory ailments. It's destructive to your whole immune system and to the strength of your body.
Causes blindness too. Massive amounts of blindness from eye infection.
From an ophthalmological sense too.
Yeah, it accelerates the cataract conditions, which are bad up there anyhow, because they're in high altitudes and the UV is not good. But this accelerates the onset of cataracts.
Can you also touch on the environmental sustainability of the resources and the limited resources that are there?
Absolutely. We use 75% less fuel. The typical fuel there is wood or crop waste or yak dung. If we use 75% less wood, there are fewer trees that have to be cut down. And in addition, it can work with very small sticks, so that people that are living alone, women particularly, whose husbands are off in the Gulf states trying to earn a living, they can just go out and pick up sticks, and they don't have to get somebody to help them cut down a tree. So it's very preserving of the environment, of the wood environment. And burning yak shit, other than the terrible smell, also takes nutrients out of the soil. Those should be allowed to decompose and go back into these poor soils. And with the dramatic reduction in soot and black carbon, there's less of that that gets into the atmosphere and falls on those very fragile glaciers in Nepal. So everything that happens in the use of this stove is environmentally sound. So, you know, Chris Bonington.
Of course, yeah. Chris Bonington, he's probably 80-something now, and he's an amazing pioneer of Himalayan climbing.
Yes, he is. And he and Jeff sponsored me into the Explorers Club in 2010. And so I knew Chris. I knew Chris actually from the time that we were in Aconcagua together, because he helped us with some of the promotion of getting this crazy blind guy up a 6,000, 7,000 meter peak. And so he's really been with us since 97. So I called him and said, how can we distribute these stoves? And he says, well, you know, call George Band at the Himalayan Trust and talk to Doug Scott and work with organizations that are already on the ground there that have an infrastructure that can take these stoves up to the communities and the villages. And that was the key that allowed us to do it without having to invest in an organization. And that's what we're still doing now.
And you're pretty bold, because you're not afraid just to like call people up and say, hey, you know, give me some thoughts here. How do I do this? You know, pick their brain, right?
That's, you know, lead, follow, or get the hell out of the way.
Have you had any struggles with the cultural adoption of a new technology in the home? I've read some stories about other products where that's a big issue, even though it's better and higher quality and has all these benefits.
It's not one that we've encountered. There are some cultural issues just because grandma used these 3-stone fireplaces in the middle of the home. But since we're using the same fuel, you know, wood or yak shit or whatever, there's not a cultural change there. It's not as if we were trying to switch them to a petroleum product or something like that. And when they see the enormous difference, and you've seen the pictures that I brought here, literally in 10 minutes we take a totally smoke-filled home and convert it to a clean environment where they can sit and breathe and enjoy life. It doesn't take much convincing
We've got three photos here, before and after, and another after, that we'll post up on our show notes, because when you see the direct impact 10 minutes later of this product, it's incredible.
As well as the unit itself. And I feel like, you know, when you and I started talking about this 10 years or so ago, I couldn't visualize it. I remember you telling me about it, but I couldn't see it. You know, theoretically, it made sense. Yes, efficiency, an exhaust, and this, the ceramic plate, all that. I was fascinated by what it conceptually could be like, but I think it's important for folks to see what it actually looks like implemented. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have an image of that as well afterwards. I want to back you up a little bit.
Okay.
Because
you always back me up.
Yes, I've got your back, George. But, you know, I know I've often referred to you, and I guess it's because you have a decade on us, times three, as you have been establishing a legacy. And I think that maybe the connotations of just the word legacy, I mean, I don't know if it really sits well with you, but you always kind of jibe me about it. Like, it's not a legacy, it's a living thing. Well, okay, I'll concede that to you. But the legacy that you have created with every one of these stoves, I am curious, do you feel like this is an extension of you honoring your son throughout each implementation? Or
every stove that we deliver is honoring him. And the legacy thing, let me segue off of that. I reached a point last year where the work involved in doing this, I've been doing it all alone, literally since 2010, and it was just getting overwhelming. So with the help of a few friends in Taos, which is home, we found a very capable woman who is now our executive director. We've got 5-6 people on the board, including Alan Arnett, who's a climber friend of all of us. And so we have now transformed from George's one-man band to a real organization that will carry on and is carrying it on. This is, they just completed the first year of having a team that's doing this. So it will continue after the day that I get buried in the ground.
And that's smart, right? Because, right, if it was like the George Bosch organization, then it dies when you die.
Right.
Right? So you want to create that.
So that's the legacy. Right.
Legacy.
You got it. Yes. That's the legacy.
So you were smart to build this and make yourself a little bit redundant.
Yeah, a lot redundant, because then I can go take 4.5 month trips. You know, that's really the fun part of it.
And you've trekked up and see these stoves in action, right? So
yes.
Do you have any like really cool experiences of just seeing the people using these things, and it just hits you like a, you know, just, yeah. Wow, I can't believe this is...
In 2011, after the samples, and 12 after the first delivery, and 13 and 14, in each of those 4 years... I went up to the villages. You know, there isn't one particular thing that stands out other than walking into homes that are not filled with smoke and with people that are really smiling. And I haven't been back to Nepal since 14 because the earthquake happened in 15. We raised some money for earthquake relief. We helped some of the villages where we'd been working, but I haven't been back since then. I'm frankly letting some younger people do that. Trekking in the Himalayas is probably history for me, because it's pretty challenging. I can do some nice hikes in Patagonia and in Antarctica, but those are a couple of hours. That's different than strapping a pack on your back and going out for days.
You had a cool story that you told me the other day, that because the stoves are portable, when the earthquake happened, what was the benefit?
The benefit was that the houses collapsed and the people were able to pick up the stoves, because they weren't particularly, they were dented a little bit, but they could take them out, they could put them under their tarpaulins where they had temporary shelter, and they could start cooking. So it was one less problem that they had to deal with.
Awesome.
Still had problems with water, with electricity, with all kinds of things, but they could cook.
Right.
George, you mentioned that your son committed suicide and that this journey of yours was a part of... perhaps a part of the recovery process for you. One of the things that always fascinates me is when people are in their darkest moments, these dark times in their lives, what role does finding a purpose play in that journey to recovery?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's very insightful, and it's very correct. And one of my mentors, just like I spent some time with you, Eric, I had a local mentor here in Colorado who said, you got to play the hand you're dealt. You do the best you can, and you do the right thing. And that has sustained me through some pretty dark times.
Yeah, that's beautiful, George.
Well, for anybody who hasn't been to Nepal and walked into a, you know, little Sherpa tea house or the lodge or home of someone and opened the door, like you said, and just been blasted by a wave of particulate smoke.
The actual smoke.
It really is. And it's overwhelming. And then to impact a family, both from a health perspective as well as just a sustainability perspective. You're contacting people on such a powerfully sort of diverse way. So, I mean, is this something that you said, I have this desire to impact the world in a positive way, I just have to figure out how? Or were you thinking to yourself, these stoves are, did you gravitate towards that simply because this was the only thing that you could think of? Or, you know, where was this?
It's one step at a time. You know, that Tom Hornby tells me that's how you climb a mountain, is one step at a time. You pursue a goal. One of my goals has always been to have live a meaningful life. When I was in Switzerland, when I was 22, when I graduated from college, I saw a headstone in Zermatt, in the little cemetery there, and it said, "Youth must be served." Some young kid that had fallen off the Matterhorn, and I scratched my head and said, "What do I want on my headstone?" And it just popped in. He made a difference. Mm-hmm. So really, from my youngest conscious age, there's been a desire to make a difference, not to build a legacy in that sense, but to make a difference by being on this planet. And I think we all have that responsibility. So I did those intermediate things, and then obviously triggered by Paul's death, I wanted to do something more meaningful to memorialize him. And that's how it evolved.
If you continue to live that life, then what's the byproduct is the legacy, right?
That's right. Yeah.
But also even beyond Paul, before Paul, you got out of Austria. Your family were pretty affected by the Holocaust. Do you think that even has some kind of shaping of who you've become?
Absolutely. No question about it.
How?
Well, I mean, it's part of the family history, the family Esperanto. You know, we had to leave when I was just learning to talk. And we had a picture of a German Shepherd in our apartment. And I, you know, being a brilliant child, I pointed to it and I said, "Dog." And so my parents...
The humility started early.
Yeah. So my parents took me out in the stroller, and they were putting up posters of Hitler on the walls. And I, you know, I thought that meant picture. And so I pointed to it and said, "Dog."
Dog.
And they hustled me back to the apartment, and I stayed in the apartment for 4 months until we got out of Austria, because they were scared to take me out on the street.
Right.
Perhaps because you were going to call a spade a spade.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But, you know, I was very politically aware at the age of one.
Right.
But yes, I mean, that's a story that, that obviously got told. I, you know, I don't remember the exact event because I literally was a year old. But that was all part of our family conversations as we became American citizens and built a new life here in the United States.
And beginning your life out of the gravity of that situation, is there kind of like a like more of a weight that sort of shoves you towards purposefulness?
No, that's a good question, and I think it's all part of that schematic of wanting to make a difference, of leading a purposeful life, of being grateful to this wonderful country to giving us the opportunity to escape the Holocaust, which was certain death over there. You know, again, I wasn't aware of it as a one-year-old child, but as you look back at history, starting when you're five or six and begin to understand these things, it's different. It's a formative experience.
So I imagine many of our listeners, and certainly many of the folks in the No Barriers community, come to the community because they really want to make a difference somehow in the world. But I would say we see a lot of people who struggle with figuring out how to do that. If you take, say, our veteran population, they've come from a community where they were making a huge difference in their military careers, and then they get out with an injury and they can't find that ability again, even though they crave it. And you strike me as someone who's been able to find it. And so how do you go about finding that way to make a difference if you're struggling?
I don't know if I can really answer that for you. I mean, personalized, I just keep looking for things to do. I don't get bored, but I also, when I find something that's good, I stick with it. That property tax company that you mentioned, Eric, that was founded 33 years ago, and we've just been doing it while other companies have fallen by the wayside, and we've adapted to changing market conditions, and we've had similar struggles in Nepal. It hasn't been a straight line, but you know, we had the idea, we started to implement it, we ran into some distribution issues and some governmental issues and so forth. So, you know, you just take a look at the current situation, you evaluate it, you try to solve the problem, to do it honestly and ethically, and get on with it. And then there's, you know, there sometimes are times when there's failure, like when I took bankruptcy. You know, Kenny Rogers, the gambler, know when to hold him, know when to fold him, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You know, be realistic in assessing your life, whether it's business life, whether it's philanthropic life, whether it's personal life with your family, friends, and issues. My take has always been to be objective, to be kind, and to be loving, but not to beat a dead horse.
Have there been times in the life of Himalayan Stove Project that you've thought, oh, game over, maybe?
I did about a year and a half ago when it was getting very difficult. And by that time, we had delivered 5,000 stoves. And I was ready to say, okay, George, good job. You've transformed the lives of 5,000 families, and we'll just let it fade off gently into the night.
What was it that was causing that? I mean, what was the
problem? It was just too much work.
It was just an overload of
just
work.
Overload of work. Okay. You know, I didn't want to spend the money to hire people. Mm-hmm. And so I was just doing everything myself other than the physical stuff in Nepal, because I've got a very good guy over there. But, you know, ordering the stoves, doing the marketing, doing the fundraising. I mean, it's like running a business. And it was just a one-man band. And it was just...
Does this sound familiar, Dave?
Yeah. It sure does.
I mean,
we've been there.
Consuming my life. And so my first thought was, okay, let's just... let it go, let it fade away. And then some friends in Taos who had been supporters for a long time said, well, you know, there is another option. And I said, yeah, are you going to help me? And they said, yes, we will. Okay. So they did. We have. And now we have a functioning organization that is only taking a modest amount of my time instead of this full-time 24/7 program.
I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, you've mentioned that you're in your early 80s. You know, as our population ages. They tend to live longer now. I see people in our community. Actually, a couple of years back, we were approached by a large retirement agency saying, we've got all these talented people who did amazing things in their professional career, and then they get to their late 60s and they retire, and they don't know what to do, and yet they have all these talents left. And I see you as someone who hasn't run into that problem. You've applied it immediately to something else. And so I guess my question is, like, thinking about that population of all the talent that's there and all that's still left in their lives to make good, what would you say to those individuals about how they find that next phase of their life?
Well, set yourself a goal of helping something, not a specific goal of starting a stove project, but of doing something other than sitting on the couch and watching football or going out and playing golf or whatever in my mind, the typical retirement thing is, or going on a cruise on a 5,000-passenger ship in the Caribbean where you can see a Broadway show. That's, to me, would be pretty unfulfilling. Look in your local community. I'm a member of Rotary. We do work in our local community. We raise money. We help disadvantaged kids. We provide winter clothing for families that can't afford it. There are lots of organizations out there. Rotary is one example. There are other service clubs that do that kind of thing. Get engaged. You know, people ask, well, what's your secret? And the only answer that I have is stay active and stay involved.
How many push-ups can you do?
Conrad challenged me to a two-minute plank a year ago, and I can do that very easily.
All right, we'll give you the plank.
Okay.
Yeah.
Give us your stats on Himalayan Stove Project and what your future is going to be.
By the end of this year, we will have delivered 6,000 stoves. And with the earthquake relief work, we've impacted 50,000 families. I'll give you one individual stat that you guys both know. Remember the Kami's brother, Tsering. Kami was our lead Sherpa at Everest, and his brother, Tsering, who brought Adam up. He didn't start school until he was 13 because he was always out gathering wood. And he now has a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a sample of one of the transformation.
Hmm.
Our goal, our short-term goal, is to be able to bring 2 containers a year over to Nepal. That's about 1,300 stoves a year. And it's all dependent upon fundraising. You know, I think the targets that we have established for this upcoming year, we'll be able to do that. We're doing it for 19, and we're targeting to do it for 20. And if the organization keeps rolling along and we get broader understanding and acceptance and check writing, then we'll be able to move up from that.
A little bit of a dovetail from what Eric said. So how can people get involved, whether it's, you know, physically or whether it's monetarily?
Get in touch with us. We have a website, HimalayanStoveProject.org, and it's got a ton of stuff on it and all the contact information. Just remember to spell Himalayan correctly. ask Mr. Google for the help on that. And you can learn an awful lot about the project, and you can learn how to get in touch with us.
What I find cool about what you're doing, too, is that you're very focused. Like, you know, a lot of organizations, even like No Barriers, we talk about scaling up and impacting more people. You're very ambitious, but yet at the same time, you're realistic. And you're like, look, I mean, I don't have to grow this into this massive empire. I'm just making a difference one stove at a time. Isn't that kind of part of the lens?
Yeah, that's well said. I you said it way better than I could have.
All right. I don't even need you in the room, George.
Well, as a public speaker.
I'll head off and go ahead and talk
to Tom Hartman. How much does, if I wanted to make a contribution to put a stove in one person's home, what is that?
$150.
Wow.
A nice dinner out someplace for a couple.
And so can you be very clear with that? That is literally from production to implementation.
That is correct. Right? That's the cost of the stove, the cost of transport, all the costs that we incur along the way getting it into somebody's home. $150 transforms the life of a family.
Yeah, generationally, right?
Yes.
We're talking about multiple generations.
That's correct.
Impacted.
And that's the cool thing about these. Some of the developing countries, some of the problems are really complex, but some of the problems aren't as complex, right? Like you just do this one simple thing based on this innovation and based on your energy, and you've made a really big impact. It's
one
pretty powerful.
One cook stove at a time, one family at a time.
Well, pretty George. Remarkable fellow, George.
Yeah, George, it's been a delight to have you on. Listeners, you can take a look at our show notes to see pictures of the stove and the before and after and tell us again the website we can go to?
HimalayanStoveProject.org. And if you do .com, it'll still take you to our website. We have both of the URLs.
It's a lot of very handsome pictures of you on that website.
Yeah, well.
Doing good work. You're more handsome when you're doing good work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being
Thanks
with us.
Thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot. Awesome. It was great, guys. Thank you.
Awesome.
Guys, another amazing guest and conversation. Let's just chat a little bit about what we heard that really stood out for us.
He's the most inspiring octogenarian I've ever met. I couldn't just wait to use that word.
You knew he was.
Yeah, I would be
down.
So
I saw you
scared
spelling
to say
something
octogenarian.
Over there.
Yeah. You got to write to put the right emphasis on the right syllable.
There's this cheesy little fable that everyone talks about, how the kids picking up starfish and throwing them into the ocean, and somebody says, you're not going to be able to save every starfish. And he's like, save that one. Mm-hmm. I love that. That's George. It's like, it's really inspiring, even, you know, for all of us, right? We've done some cool things, but to say, what can I do in my life that's going to create that legacy, as you said, Jeff? I mean, I think we're all capable of a lot more than we think if we have the lens that George has.
I wonder if his foot on his accelerator pushes harder as he gets older. And I just wonder about that how we all age, and as we age, where do we find that intention and that purpose that you spoke of, Dave? Like, you know, I'm so inspired listening to it because you know, I mean, I'm about to crest over a pretty big chronological milestone myself, and sitting with George and listening and watching him over the decades do this, I mean, I tell you, it is just fuel for me.
Yeah.
He's just such a remarkable man who harnessed his passion, found the place to be able to push it, and then connected dots.
And as your window on, you know, as part of life on Earth gets smaller, maybe do speed up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that is the message, right?
For some
speed
people,
up, get it. You better get it done.
Go. Yeah. Don't linger. There's no moss that's going to develop under George Bosch's rocks, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I guess I was thinking back to a conversation we had with this individual, Ethan, from Ethiopia. You can look in our past shows if you want to hear this. But one of the things that struck me in that conversation is each terrible adversity that Ethan had come across, he kind of just talked about it. It's like, what happened? And I moved on and I found a way. And I heard that same theme in George's life of, you know, he just kind of throws out, oh, you didn't know I went bankrupt. My son committed suicide. And yet he continued to just find a way to have purpose and meaning and to live fully, which I think is not as easy as it sounds for a lot of our listeners, for me personally. And yet individuals like George figure it out. And I think they guide us and they show us it is possible in those moments to just continue. And one, as he said, one step in front of the other. That's the way you get through it.
Use the cards you're dealt. I love that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because sometimes you do get a yak shit hand. And you gotta work with that hand and make it work and eke impact out of it.
I'm not gonna let go personally the idea of the legacy either, because I find it as a wonderful byproduct that if we do the right thing and we harness these passions and we put them in the right places, that what happens? We impact the world, and then long after we're gone, that legacy lives on and defines the work of that individual. And therein lies George Bosch.
And if you wanna get a little bit of that spirit in you, that George Bosch spirit, what better place to get it than by coming June 13th to 15th to the No Barriers Summit? I think we all get a little bit of that spirit of what's possible by attending that event. And so we started our show reminding you that's coming up. But if you want to have that inspiration and that moment of saying, wow, there's more that I can do, there's more contribution I can make and get inspired by what's possible, mm-hmm. The No Barriers Summit is a great place to do that. NoBarriersSummit.org, June 13th to 15th in Lake Tahoe.
Exciting stuff.
Cool. Thanks, everyone. No barriers.
Thanks. See you next time.
Thanks to all of you for listening to our podcast. We know that you have a lot of choices about how you can spend your time, and so we appreciate you spending it with us. If you enjoy this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to it, share it, and give us a review. Show notes can be found at nobarrierspodcast.com. Special thanks to the Dan Ryan Band for our intro song, which is called Guidance. The production team behind this podcast includes producers Diedrich Jonk and Pauline Schaefer, sound design, editing, and mixing by Tyler Kottman, Graphics by Sam Davis and marketing support by Laura Baldwin and Jamie Donnelly. Thanks to all you amazing people for the great work you do. Our minds, they-